I wanted to ask you what led you to choose this approach of focusing on four American communities for your film?
Well, we wanted to tell the story of the Second World War unmediated by the usual distractions of World War II documentaries. And those distractions are generals and politicians who actually don't do the fighting and the dying, strategy and tactics that abstract the human cost of war, and weapons and armaments that aren't germane, it seems to me, to what actually takes place in war. And there's an urgency about this, is there not, since we're losing 1,000 veterans a day in our country. And so my co-producer and co-director, Lynn Novick, and I decided that we would try to tell a story entirely from the bottom up. And the best way to do this with something as big as the Second World War, this is the greatest cataclysm in human history, is to just arbitrarily take some random towns, Waterbury, Connecticut, Mobile, Alabama, Sacramento, California, and Laverne, and say, let's find out what we can discover there, and to bring back the stories of the so-called ordinary people, who of course remind us in every gesture and breath that there are no ordinary people, and weave their stories together in such a way that the Second World War comes alive in a horrific fashion. I think we give you access to battle scenes that I think will change the way you view the Second World War, but also in the personal and the heroic and the emotional and all the ways in which our own values as Americans are very much tied into what our parents or our grandparents did when they were so young so very long ago.
What led you to choose Laverne, Minnesota?
Well, actually, we were thrashing about trying to, we already picked the other three towns, and they were about 100,000 population each during at the time of Pearl Harbor. But we knew we wanted a small Midwestern town, and we had already met a fighter pilot named Quentin Amundsen, who's lived outside of Washington, D.C. for the last 50 years. His story is so compelling, and his first day of work is June 6, 1944, and he would go on in the next 10 months to see so much, to deal out death, to see friends die, to nearly die himself, and to come close to despair, but never lose sight of what he was fighting for and why. And he said he had grown up in Laverne, Minnesota. So we took that cue, came out, and in the process of, almost instantly in the process of investigation, discovered in the archives the editor of the Rock County Star, Harold, a man named Al McIntosh, who, though he passed away in 79, wrote so beautifully about the war and how it was affecting Laverne. It wasn't outwardly changed as the other three towns became boom towns, but he understood the inner spiritual, psychological story, and we were able to get Tom Hanks to read his part, and it's, he just gets more and more central to the story of this war in our film as these episodes go by.
And we've had a chance to watch a couple of them, and,
couple, yeah.
And they're wonderful, very moving. I had a chance to view one episode with some students that I teach, and they became emotional, as a lot of people do. What kind of reactions do you have, Ken, when you sit with these people as you make the film and hear their stories for the first time?
Well, I have all the same reactions you do, and I did last night. You know, I'd like to think of myself as an emotional archaeologist. I'm uninterested in the dry dates and facts and events of the past. This is a much more important story that we're telling, how ordinary people, not only what they did, but what they felt. And that's the story that we've tried to tell in this. And so as we were conducting the interviews, Lynn and I, we would sometimes cry ourselves when we heard a poignant story or realized that a veteran was sharing something with us he had not yet spoken, that we were present at the birth of expressed memory, that the sun would turn that when the reel was being changed and say, Pop, you never told us that before, that we were getting something new. It was very poignant. And then again, as we were trying to work them together and trying to form a cohesive, coherent narrative to tell, and then now as we share it, we've been out and about in the country hearing clips from the film, and it is, the reactions are very, very poignant.
There is some profanity in this film, and we heard some last night during the segment about American and German planes and dogfights over France. Did you encourage your subjects to express themselves freely in that way, or did that just come out of them?
That just came out. We would never encourage. And I just want to stress to your listeners that last night there were two very modest words that were uttered in the midst of a man describing what it was like to be attacked by German fighter planes in a B-17. And he just, in the middle of it, uttered words that most of us unfortunately bump into almost every day. That is more than 50% of what you'll hear in this film. So there is so few and far between. My comment on this is that in order to win this war, our young men sometimes had to employ languages, usually adjectives, that they wouldn't have used back home in front of their mom. I forgive them for it. The American people forgive them for it. And we just permitted in this one instance for this fellow's story to just go forward.
And for what it's worth, it was real, and I commend you for it, and I think most people would understand.
Oh, of course. And remember, we've already had an incredible precedent-setting thing when Saving Private Ryan, which is a work of fiction with dozens of uses of the F-word, and therefore, because it is a work of fiction, could be argued that every time it's used is gratuitous, has already been broadcast on television in prime time to sensitive ears, and nobody put up a fuss. And this is real and true, and I think no one, particularly the veterans, would want anything soft-sell. Having said that, I would never put in a gratuitous obscenity ever in my life. That's just not the way I operate. I'm a parent of three daughters.
Ken Burns is our guest. His documentary, The War, took 6 years to make. Ken, is this as long as you've spent doing a film, and why did you need that much time?
Well, for us, it was important to get to know these people, get to know the towns, get to know their stories, understand where their personal archives were, but also be able to tell the story by going to the archives around the world, hundreds and hundreds of places, from Tokyo and Berlin to Moscow and London, to mostly to the United States and our glorious national archives, and plumbing the depths. If you're a filmmaker, say from the History Channel, and you're making a film about the Second World War, you basically have just a short amount of time to go in and take the footage, and you usually take it off the front table, the greatest hits. We had the luxury that other filmmakers, other colleagues of mine don't always have, which is we could spend those 6 years wisely finding never-before-seen footage, bringing to life color material that hasn't seen the light of day since it was shot. And all of that adds an air of verisimilitude, not just in the horror of battles, but sometimes in the quiet moment. We have a beautiful scene coming up tomorrow night of soldiers just giving each other shaves and haircuts as their uniforms are drying in the hedgerows of Normandy before the breakout that will liberate Paris and push the Germans back to their own border. I mean, just these little tiny moments mean so much, and we were just able to spend enough time to get that and find that in the depths of the archives.
One last question. This film has produced a backlash from the Latino community, which felt that the service of Hispanic Americans and their stories were overlooked, and it's still being discussed. How do you respond to that criticism?
Well, it was painful to begin with because, first of all, it was coming from people who had never seen a single frame of our film. And, you know, Americans usually are fair and they like to judge things. They like to talk about things they know. It was never our intention to be definitive at this. Indeed, by picking the four towns, we don't tell lots of different stories, not just of different ethnic groups, but also of different branches of military service or types of combat experience or certain battles. We weren't trying to do that. You couldn't do that. You can't be encyclopedic. But I'm also in the memory business and the history business, and so I listened very carefully, and we actually went out and we filmed a couple of Hispanic veterans and added them to people saw that the first night, a totally amazing story at the end of the first night, and they're as good as anything in the film. We're just happy to say that we didn't alter the creative vision of the film we finished, but we were also able to continue to add stories. And those of you in the Northern Plains will be happy when you hear at the end of our fifth episode another story, which I had always wanted to include, about a Crow Indian warrior named Joe Medicine Crow, who has one of the most amazing stories to tell. And I figured if I'm going to do an extra story or two, I'll just do a third one, and we tell Joe Medicine Crow's story. And no Native American group had protested when, in fact, there were no Native Americans who came forward. I think this situation arose from the fact that we didn't go out seeking any particular ethnic group. We just were seeking combat experience, and these veterans are so reticent to speak that we could only take who came forward. And in the course of our 5 years spent in these towns, not a single Hispanic came forward. And when I doubled back to ask them, how come no one from your community came forward, they said, you know, the heroes were our friends we left behind. We didn't want to be self-aggrandizing, exactly what nearly every other veteran says. And so we are even more doubly grateful to those veterans who appear in our film, who have graciously and with no small amount of reluctance told their stories, and I think combined to make the best film I've ever been involved in. So the numbers have surprised everyone. They're almost as great as our Civil War series, and this is 17 years later when there are 10 times the number of television stations. People are watching in the same numbers. The book is a bestseller. The music is flying off the shelf with the beautiful tune by Nora Jones, The American Anthem, which, if there's any justice in the world, this beautiful, talented young woman with a voice from God will be forced to sing this tune, American Anthem, at the halftime of the Super Bowl. I think it's that good. So I hope your listeners agree, and we can continue this conversation together as we go forward through the series and through our own attempts to get our own relatives to talk and to speak and to share their stories before they pass on.
I'm sure our listeners do agree, and I just want to say congratulate you on what may be your best work. And I know that you have been very, very busy, so I appreciate, Ken, you're taking the time to make time for us.
Paul, it's the other way around. Thank you so much for giving a megaphone. I was just in South Dakota a couple of weeks ago. It's so great to be there always. I've spent a lot of time there because of our Lewis and Clark project and our West project, and I just want to see how pleased I am that everybody's watching, and they've grabbed Grandma and the kids, but not too young, and watched the film together. We really think it's better to be together as a people than apart.
We'll be watching tonight. Ken Burns, again, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Bye-bye now.